I'm delighted to be talking today with Lucy Simpson, a Nez Perce tribal elder and co-founder of Nimiipuu Protecting the Environment, a tribal grassroots organization. The name Nimiipuu means the people, which is what the Nez Perce call themselves. The group works to save Idaho and eastern Washington's vast waterways, including the Salmon, Snake, and Clearwater rivers, and the salmon and other aquatic life that depend on them. They also work on behalf of wolves, grizzlies, and other wildlife, the plants, and their ecosystems. Lucy has 2 degrees, both from the white world and the Indian world, in policing and criminal law enforcement, and she even went undercover in her pursuit of criminals. She was on the ground floor of the Nez Perce Tribal Law Enforcement Department, and indeed its first woman. Lucy is also a teacher, an artist, a doll maker, an expert on plants and native medicines, and a great-grandmother. We chatted on the banks of the Lacsaw River last July at a gathering of enthusiastic grizzly bear and environmental activists that was organized by Brett Haverstick and Wilderness Watch. We start this conversation with Lucy talking about Julian Matthews, another co-founder of Nimiipuu Protecting the Environment, who also helped recruit her for the Tribal Law Enforcement Department.
Julian said, well, we need to get a department. And I said, okay. I said, what do you want me to do? He says, I want you to help with the 638, and that's change it from government to tribal. And I said, okay, but I said, I want something from you first. I said, I want to travel to the Colville, to Yakima, and to Umatilla tribal police departments to see how they are running, work with the chief of police there for a week or so. So he had to go ask the fathers that be, Neptic, if we could do that. And they gave us their blessing. And so off I went. I stayed with each chief of police for 1 week. And learned everything about their tribe from top to bottom, their jail, their court system, their tribal codes, everything.
Wow.
Top to bottom.
Like learning in different nations.
Yeah, and brought all that back to Julian and then he says, well, we got the paperwork now to do the transfer, but you got to fill it out. So all I had to do is fill out what forms we needed to do the 638 so that we could get a department. So I told him, I said, we need about 11 officers. That's what we started with because, you know, 3 didn't cut it for 175-mile radius. So we got what we wanted. We wanted 11 officers. So the department started with 11. And now it's double or triple that. You know, there's quite a few more officers now, but that was a start, and that's when I first met Julian in the late 90s. So that's what I did. But I worked Orofino City for the city of Orofino as their first police woman and first Indian police for the department. But I was not the first tribal police officer there. There was a U.S. Marshal, and his name was Alex Pinkham. He had gotten out of World War One or two, I don't remember which one it was. And he came back from the war and they made him the marshal, the U.S. marshal on the Nez Perce Reservation. And so that's what they did. But he also enforced the law of the non-Indians. And the non-Indian people didn't like that. So they took him off and said, we need white officers to handle these Indians. So they took his job away from him and then gave it to non-tribal officers. And that was a bad mistake. And see, that's then we got the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and then now we've got tribal. Mm-hmm. So tribal seems to be a little bit better for the people.
Right.
They can communicate real easy with our people. Even if they're non-tribal, they still know, they still go to the Tribal Police Academy. Of course, I went to Idaho State Police Academy in Boise. At that time, it was in Boise.
Mm-hmm.
But that was in the 90s before I worked with Wenatchee. I had to go through the police academy a second time because I went in the 70s and finished. And then I worked with Wenatchee. And then I was getting my criminal justice degree, and I was out over a year and a half. So they said, oh, you have to go back through the academy. I was darn near 50 years old. And they said, you got to go back because you've been out over a year and a half.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
So I went back and, survived. There's another older guy that I really worked with. We shared vitamins and, you know, we were more, had more things in common. We're both older. He retired from the military and, you know, we're both older. And so we shared vitamins and things and talked a lot. So then Julian, then they asked me, well, who do you want to hire for the chief of police here? Mm-hmm. And they thought I'd hire myself. I said, no. I said, Tom Idle was my buddy at the police academy. He had secret, in the military, had secret status. And he was originally from Puerto Rico, so he spoke Spanish fluently. And I said, he's the guy to hire because he's already cultural, you know, appropriate for the job. So that's who they hired, is my buddy at the police academy. They didn't even really, you know, they, of course, they did their check on him and everything, but they picked him and said they were going to go ahead and hire him then because I said he was right for the job. So
what was your biggest challenge there?
My biggest challenge when I was there in the 70s was being a female and being Indian. Because when I went to Wenatchee, officers told me, you don't belong here. You're a woman. You know, you're taking a man's job, you know. And so I left their sergeant. They pissed me off. So I left their sergeant, training sergeant. They pissed me off. They shouldn't have done that. So anyway, I was the corporal of the 4th platoon. And then I became the sergeant, training sergeant. And that's what I did. So, and we did all sorts of things like teaching them how to do bank robberies, mock bank robberies. We go in there and we fire off rounds and things, but it's got scary because we're always worried about the public, like up in Lake Chelan, that's where we did our practices. We're worried about some John Q citizen walking in and thinking it was a real bank robbery and killing us all because I was a bad guy usually, you know? So anyway, that was one of the things. But when I first went to Wenatchee, they didn't have a female restroom. They only had a male restroom and it had doors on both sides. And I had to change in there. And the guys would knock on both doors. Come on, get out of there. I'm getting in the bathroom. And I said, well, I'm trying to hurry. Gosh. There was no female dressing room, no female restroom, nothing. But I did what I could. And then finally, they got all that stuff, but it took a while. And so I just hung with that. And from 80 to 87, we had the civil liberties bombings then. They bombed one state trooper car in East Wenatchee. And then they bombed one of the Wenatchee police officer's garage. And that was 25 feet from his dining room at his house. And they bombed it. So what we had to do is go out and keep our eye open for you know, people with bombs and that sort of thing. So we'd be going down alleys. And then they said they were going to bomb the federal building, which was the post office and all, IRS and post office, all that good stuff in one building there. And so they sent me in undercover, and I had to use the telescope to look around to see if there was anybody up in different places because I was dyslexic. And in that telescope, everything's backward, but I could see it forward because I'm dyslexic. So they liked that. And the other thing they liked was when I'd patrol with a guy, I could see the license plate. If I looked in the mirror, I could see it the correct way because my dyslexic. I could read that plate. He said, what's that plate behind us? And I'd read it off to him. And so they liked that. And I wasn't scared of any weapon. I wasn't afraid of any 12 gauge. I wasn't scared of any 357, 38, nothing. So then I did that. And then I went back to finish my criminal justice. They said, you need your criminal justice degree. So I went back to Lewiston and got that. And then
Wait a second. What was your cover?
I was just, at that time, it was just just being someone looking in a post office, like I was a cleaning woman or something.
Okay.
Supposed to be going in.
Sorry.
And, because that was one cover. But then the other time I was a Mexican woman because they had this place that that was selling weapons, and they were thought to have sold weapons to illegal aliens. So that's illegal, of course. So they sent me in. I had a scarf on. I had to speak a little Espanol and walk in with my spouse, you know, and play the part as his wife. And Joe, he was another police officer that spoke Spanish. He was Ruiz, Joe Ruiz. Mm. And so we went in there as husband and wife. Mm. But we couldn't get anything on them. So they were clearly
curious.
So, but then another thing that went on over there in Wenatchee was, of course, they had me work the Mexican, the Indian, and the biker section of town. And there were 6 camps along the Columbia River, and they'd had me work that too. So all these transients were there, and then the bikers, Indians, and all that, they had different bars in the south end of Wenatchee. So that's where they put me. You know, because of my color. Mm-hmm. And so I worked that. And then they gave me a call and they said that there were bikers that were going up to Chelan Courthouse and they didn't know why. And they were worried. So they sent me to respond. And I go driving up there and I've put my lights on. These bikers are Ghost Riders was their name. Biker group from around. And they were going up to the courthouse. And made police nervous. So I went up there and I said, hey, what y'all guys doing? What you guys doing here? They said, oh, well, I'm the secretary and blah, 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 president, blah, blah, blah. And we're going to bail one of our friends that got thrown in jail for drunkenness or something. And I said, oh, okay. Well, he says, yeah. He said, we're just going to get him out, bail him out, and then we're going to leave town. I said, oh, okay. No problem. You know, all right, we'll see you then. Shook hands. They left. And so, you know, there was so many different times that, you know, it was different for me as a woman. You know, I just did what I had to do. And they had what they call an apple blossom festival there where people get rowdy and drunk and raise cane and all this stuff. And I had this teenager girl that was sticking her rear end out her window of the car. She was riding there. And I told her, all right, sit down and get that rear end on your seat. And so she jumped in her car and sat down. And I thought, okay. And I was doing foot patrol, walking around the streets and with another officer as my backup. And here we see that girl again. She coming around the corner. She has her butt hanging out the window. I grabbed her by her Levi jacket and I yanked her out like that. And then they started calling me the mean Indian woman. I was mean. So I got the name as a mean Indian police officer for taking that girl out the window. But I didn't want her to fall on her little bottom, you know, hurt herself or, you know. So anyway, so that was one thing. And so then, you know, people were saying, well, you need to get your criminal justice. So that's when I went to work on that. And while at school, I took a job as a alcohol drug counselor at the prison. So I taught alcohol and drug classes to the prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got contacted by the chief of police for Orofino. And I was just about ready to graduate. And he said, can you come work for me as a police officer? And I loved my boss, the director of the alcohol drug program at the prison. And she was a great woman. And I just hated to leave her. And I said, well, no, you know, I don't think so. And he kept coming back and saying, we need you on our force. And he did that. He made phone calls. He walked in. And finally, I told him, my boss, and he told me how much I could make. And I said, So I told my boss, I said, I'm sorry, boss. I think I'll take this job. So I got on as police officer. And I was the first Indian woman and first female officer that Orofino City had.
Well,
and I did my job, and it was hard because we were right in the middle of the Nez Perce Reservation. So But anything that happened to the Indians outside on the reservation, we couldn't do anything about because that was not our jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And if the Bureau of Indian Affairs officer needed backup, and I could go up to help him in the hood, in the housing. Mm-hmm. So that was the only time. Otherwise, I'd have to sit in the Wenatchee zone. Mm-hmm. Until he called me. And if he didn't call me, I just went about my business and did whatever. But just in case he needed backup, I would wait for him. Mm-hmm. So on the same token, he backed me up. I was driving across Orofino Bridge, and it was the old bridge that had the overhang on it and that. And there was a guy coming across the bridge, and he had his license plate dangling, and it was an old Continental. And so... anyway, I was going Riverside Avenue, and I pulled him over, and I was just going to tell him, your license plate's dangling. Could you please get it fixed? So I started approaching the vehicle, and I saw an AK-47 on the floor, and there was another guy sitting on the other side, and this guy was driving, and he was like a big guy in a Continental. He made the car look small. So anyway, it had a banana clip, and it was loaded, ready to go. So I just, I said, driver's license, registration, you know, I got that stuff from him. And I said, just one moment. I said, I just stopped you because your license plate was dangling. I'll be right back with you. So I slowly backed up, went to my patrol car, radioed in for backup. None of the guys would help me on the Clearwater County or Orofino because they said, she's a woman. She can handle herself. So the BIA officer was coming from Kamei, and he said, you know, he'd assist. So he came flying from Kamei to help me on Riverside Avenue. And I sat in my car kind of waiting a little bit and just checked his place and everything was all right. But it just kind of looked kind of funny. But we put him under arrest for having that weapon, you know, like that. On this floor. So we did a felony stop, took him in. But he had money because I guess his family worked at the bullet factory or something. But we searched his car while he was incarcerated. And it looked like he just delivered drugs. His mat from the car was loose. And he had a big block of wood that had a police officer picture on there with bullet holes in it. And he had a bunch of rounds of bullets on his floor. And, you know, this kind of looked kind of a bad. And he was coming, you know, I don't know if he came from Canada, just dropped off or was heading home. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
Is that about the scaredest you've been?
Well, I wasn't really afraid.
Well, okay.
What happened was I called out my call and I said, Murphy's Corner. Well, that was my mom's, where my mom lived, Murphy's Corner over in Silver Lake, Washington by Everett. Okay. So I know my mom was deceased and she was watching over me. Mm. So I called Murphy's Corner and the dispatch has come back. And I go, I'm on Riverside, 1424 Riverside. So I repeated, you know, okay, this is where I'm at by the old Sears building now. So anyway, you know, I gave her my information and that. So I know, you know, I didn't have to be afraid. My mom was looking out for me.
She's over your shoulder.
I knew it. I could feel it. Mm-hmm. So I was safe, mm-hmm. You know, in my Indian way, I believe she's looking out for me. Mm-hmm. So, because I know different times I could have been injured in Wenatchee. I was crawling on the ground with my weapon out. There was a guy in the house with a shotgun, and he was going to blow anybody away that came in the door. And he was holding this roommate at bay. And so anyway, we had to go in there and take the rifle away from him. And so I was calling him along with my weapon out, but survived. And you know, I think everything that I went through there, I survived. Arrested prostitution, people, you know, that were prostitutes and stuff. And there was a lot to do, you know, but I made it, and I made it as far as working with Julian.
Yeah. So when did you connect with Julian? Because you've been You co-founded NIMBYPU Protecting the Environment.
Oh, he and I.
Many years ago. Mm-hmm. About salmon and fish.
Well, what happened was I was interested in the megalodes. And so I told Julian, well, there was other people there. So I asked him, what do you do to get involved in this? I said, oh, Julian takes care of everything. Just talk to him and then go from there on. So then I did. And then he knew me because we worked together in the past, and he knew my cultural background because, of course, he knew, you know, I knew a lot of things about my culture and tradition. So anyway, that's how I connected with him. And then he asked me to be a member of, and then that was just after that was a flotilla, our first flotilla. So we had that flotilla and went on that, and I helped him with that and helped set up. And then he started asking me to speak at different things with my cultural background and my ability to work with kids.
Right.
So,
because listeners may not know, the megalodes was a huge issue.
Yes.
We take these huge loads over down this river,
right,
dumping trucks into this river and everything, and onto the reservation and all the rest. And it didn't actually, from my view, in Montana, Southwest Montana, looked like it could be stopped. And suddenly, here's my view, you can speak. There was this small but ferocious group who basically said no, and you stopped it. I mean, was that your big first victory?
Well, mine was coming up the river because he said they were going to be heading to Lowell. And so he sent me up this way, and that's where I ended up. But they ended up going on through, and the people that were there just had headed home. So
yeah. Okay.
They couldn't stop them or whatever. The state trooper was there, and they didn't want to get involved with the state trooper out in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
So,
But you were working law enforcement during that time.
I was working for the tribe in voc rehab.
Oh.
Yeah. Because they needed somebody for that position. And when I started there, I had like 90 caseloads, so I did that. But Julian knew me. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we connected. He knew me from the past. And of course, my resume and my history on what I did. So
how did NIMBYPU Protecting the Environment come about? What was kind of
Julian and Elliot Moffat got together, and they said, hey, you know, this really needs some grassroots type of people to help these issues, because when the tribe gets involved, it makes the tribe look bad. But if we're grassroots, then they can't say much because we're just grassroots people, you know, from the street, you know, just from the working population. And we're not NEPTIC and we're not, you know, council, nothing like that. We're just average human beings. And we had to be out there and willing to, do the things that we did. We had to be willing to stand up and face people. We had to be willing to talk to congressmen. We had to be willing to talk to any state representative. So that's how we came about. And he's sent me, I've gone to D.C. to talk, to meet with all the representatives on Capitol Hill as a tribal elder. I went over there, and he sent Chapman with us, Carrie Chapman. She came over with us, and her son that passed away, Mike Walker, came over with us. But I think because of his job, and he's been busy working HR different times, he would send me to do different things to represent, because he knew he couldn't travel, or he knew he couldn't get time off, or it was bad timing. So sometimes he just sent me to do things, like he sent me downtown to reach his office, and, you know, just meet with some of the representatives and that. So I would do that. And I met with Mike Simpson when he first had his plan in his office on Capitol Hill. And we hit it off pretty good because we both had the name Simpson. I said, oh, Mike, I like that name Simpson. And so I started explaining how I got the name Simpson. I said, my deceased husband got that name from the fur company, the Hudson Bay Fur Company, Simpson Fur Company. And so I said, he was a friend of theirs. So when it come along to giving the English names, he didn't have an English name. So Simpson said, go ahead and take mine. And so I told this to Mike Simpson. He says, wow. He said, that's great. You know, good story. He really liked that. So we connected right off the bat, you know. And he was supposed to talk to the other delegation, but I was the only one he talked to. And then by the time we were finished, it was time to go look at his map on a wall. So I said, well, come on, I'll get my assistant to show you guys the map on the wall, the idea that I have for the...
That's how politics works. You got my name?
You have to connect someplace. You have to take the humanistic approach to be able to do things like that. And, you know, I heard Joe Biden just after I said, breach the dams and do it now. I heard Biden say, do it now. You know, a couple months after I made that speech on the river. And that's funny. He said the same thing I did. Do it now. I was like, but I learned that as a police officer. Do it now. But he said, do it now, in a different tone.
Right.
So that's kind of how that came about. And then they decided to get in with Sam Mace, is it? Well, the Sam from Spokane, who used to be the one that connected with the dams and was for the salmon. From Spokane, I can't remember. Sam Mace, I thought what her name was. Anyway, so then we connected with a lot of other people and different tribes. And when we connected with them, different tribes had their canoes, and we didn't have one. So Julian and Elliot said, we need to build a canoe. Okay, all right. Okay. So then he said, we can get the kids to do this canoe. And it'll be the first in over 100 years. And, you know, that, how that story is on the internet, that's what we did is we involved the kids. And we had to take it, the good with the bad, because they would, we would tell them there's these two-inch dowels there. Don't go past that dowel because the boat will be too low. And, of course, you know, kids, they whittled at it, made some spots too low. So Julie and those guys made little wooden butterflies to patch them. Spots on the canoe. So if you look inside the canoe, you'll see those butterflies where the kids got carried away with the canoe.
Well, and now, like, that canoe made a huge difference.
Yeah, you gotta let the kids do what they're gonna do. You teach them safety about these things, and then you teach them, we haven't had one of these over 100 years. You're gonna be making history by this. And they loved it. And their parents were interested in it. We got the community interested in it. We held several meetings in the community. We got elder interest. Just a lot of interest, and people just hung with it. And some of the elders hung with it. I mean, they're still hanging with it. You know, Julian, how you guys doing now? You know, and they were, when we first started making the canoe, we got in touch with Bob Chenoweth at the, then he worked the Park Service in Esperance National Park. And so he got involved and told us, this is how you do it. This is the dugout of one of the Nez Perce tribal dugouts, Tawatoy's dugout, and they got that dugout from, I think it was Great Falls at a museum. They said, we don't want this dugout anymore, and it happens to be one of Chief Joseph's brothers, so we'll take it. So it's stored down at the Nez Perce National Park Service. So we got to go down and look at all the canoes they have in storage in their storage facility. And Bob Chenoweth, he did research on the canoes, so we had a kind of like a class, of course, with him. And he talked to us about the canoe and how we should do it and what type of wood and all this and that. So that's kind of how we got started with that.
Well, it made the point about fish and the rivers and salmon and the dams, which was obviously part of your point, you know, in addition to the cultural connection.
Yes.
And you've been working on that for quite a while.
Yes, we have.
Seems like you're making headway.
Well, we have connected with other organizations that seem to be like sister partners to us or whatever, and they kind of work along with us. And so it makes it better. And a lot of them are non-tribal, some river rafting people and different people. If we can connect with other people and have one commonality, then we can make progress on something. Like I said, you know, with Mike Simpson, one commonality connected us. And with these river rafter people, commonality, the fish, the water. Well, the thing is that the Nez Perce have such a connection with all the animals, mm-hmm. the four-leggeds, the two-leggeds, and it's been since time immemorial mm-hmm. that we've had those connections. One story that my father told me about the grizzly bear is that he was Nooksack from the coast, and he said that these boys... He said they, before there was a borderline, Canadian border, he said these young boys went out hunting for elk and deer and moose kind of toward Canada because the Nooksack tribe is close and Bellingham's close to the border. So they were gone hunting horseback. And they were always told, do not shoot the grizzly bear. That is something that is a well-respected animal, you know, among our people, leave the grizzly bear alone. You know, they didn't mind the black bear because there was a lot of them and they weren't significant to the tribe as the grizzly bear is. It's a spiritual type thing as well as, you know, power and these other things the grizzly bear has. And so these young men were out hunting and they didn't get anything. They couldn't find any elk, couldn't find any deer, they couldn't find anything. And they looked down this little meadow, and they saw a grizzly bear down there. And they said, you know, looked at each other on horseback. They said, should we kill him? And they decided, well, let's shoot him. And we don't have to tell, you know, anybody we shot him, you know. And so they shot that grizzly bear, and there was a log like this that went along, and the grizzly bear was right beside that log. And the grizzly bear, after they shot him, slumped over that log, and it turned into an old Indian. And that's when the boys realized that this is spiritual. This animal has spirit. And my dad also said there were people that you had the grizzly bear as a clan. The Haidas have... The grizzly bear is one of their clans, and there's other tribes that have the grizzly bear clan because of what it means to the people. And so, you know, that's the story my dad told me on the Nooksack side.
Lucy had an uncle on the Palouse side. Indeed, her family extends throughout the Pacific Northwest. He shared this story about grizzly bear and coyote.
The story that he told me was that many years ago, this was over there on the other side of Dayton, along the water over there. There was the grizzly bear and the coyote. And the grizzly bear was fishing for salmon. And he was just walking back and forth and fishing. And he stepped on a baby coyote and killed it. You know, how big the grizzly bear is. He stepped on it and he killed it. And he probably felt bad about it, but the coyote was mad. You killed my pup. And so what happened was they became enemies, and coyote said, well, I'm going to get you back, grizzly bear. And so he goes and digs a deep pit, and he puts fir boughs on top of that pit, and he covers it over. And then grizzly bear comes along, and he falls in that pit. And coyote slayed him. And then coyote took him out of there, and he cooked him up, and he invited all his friends to eat grizzly bear. And so they all came, and ate, and that was his payback for killing that pup. And since this happened, they became enemies for life, so that the grizzly bear has its own territory that coyote cannot cross. And grizzly bear doesn't go on a coyote's territory. They leave each other alone now because of this, what happened. And that was a Palouse story. So, and that was an old story because my uncle, his mother, we had her bones shipped back from New York because they dug her up. She died in Palouse country by Palouse Falls area. And Lyons Ferry. And so how they used to be, they dig up the Indians to examine them, take them back, study them, do all this thing. They had her in a little box in the museum. So anyway, he learned all these things from his great-grandmother that lived over there. And when we got her bones back from D.C., they had passed that return of bones. We got the bones back of his grandmother, and we took them over and buried them in an undisclosed location, just like we did Ancient Man. Ancient Man's location cannot be revealed. His grandmother's site of burial over by Lions Fair, over that way somewhere, mm-hmm. we can't reveal what location that is mm-hmm. either. But he learned these stories firsthand from his grandmother that was Palouse, that had lived in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So, because there used to be a longhouse on the Palouse above the falls, and people would go there to meet and do different things above mm-hmm. the falls. Well, of course, nothing's there now, and Indians can't do that. And they were told, you need to go find a reservation. You can't live here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So leave, or you're going to get killed. And so some of them fled to the Kalva Reservation. Some fled to Yakima, and some fled to the Nez Perce Reservation.
Oh, okay.
And that's how Palouse blood got mixed, and some went to Umatilla. That's how Palouse blood got mixed up, is they had to leave.
Right.
Because they were going to build those dams. They wanted them out of there. And that's what happened to Carrie Chapman's family as well.
Okay.
They were told to leave.
Right.
And so,
you haven't left.
Yeah. No.
The wolves haven't left.
No.
The grizzly bears might have left, but they're back.
Yeah.
And what kind of feeling does that give you?
Yeah, I think that's why I did bring this item. And I do want us to do a small ceremony this evening. And this pipe comes from Paha Sapa, comes from the Back Hills. And my son is the pipe carrier. I'm the pipe keeper. So what I do is, until my son is ready for the pipe, I keep the pipe with me. And so this is from Paha Sapa. The Black Hills, and it was made in the Black Hills. And so it means a lot to us. And one day, you know, since my son's named after old Joseph, he will care for this pipe. He will master this pipe and take care of it. So this is the part. This comes from Paha Sapa. And
so you have to be strong.
And
right.
Red Leaf made this, and he said there's only a certain amount of them that carry the Red Leaf name, and my son is one who carries the Red Leaf pipe. So we were going to use that this evening in a little ceremony.
In what follows here, Lucy shares some of what she learned from her grandfather and other relatives about plants and plant medicine. She starts by describing collecting black moss from trees.
It's the black moss that you get from the trees. And during my younger days, I used to have to, my older sister would put me on her shoulders and I'd have to reach up and grab the moss and take it down. And then we'd help grandma clean it. And then we'd put it in a pot and we cooked the mush. And that was our mush.
Wow. Oh.
And then we also, I've been up to post office getting cows up there. Al Pinkham and I went up there, and he said, there's cows up there. So we went up there for a drive, and then we got some cows out of that area. But there's all sorts of things around this area that we still use today as our natural foods. We didn't go to McDonald's, you know, back then. We came out here. There's a lot of food around here. I've got a friend that her son's having health problems. She's collecting dandelions and feeds him the dandelions to help his health issue. And that's what we do. And, you know, that is our priority, is natural foods, natural, traditional over McDonald's and KFC, all these other things. It helps. And there's this woman's root. I didn't bring all my things, but there's this woman's root called cows. And that's what the Nez Perce women took when they were in battle. They took that root with them because it keeps them well. And it helps them when many die and the children are left orphaned and all these things that happen to them. They needed to keep well, to be a foster parent, to be the one to help the elders. You know, they needed that. So they had that woman's root called Kaus. And I still take that and I teach my grandchildren, great grandchildren. I have 8 great grandchildren and I teach them about those foods and I do things with them in the Indian way. So they will not forget, even though they're like this high, they still remember. I have a 3-year-old granddaughter and I have an eagle fan that doesn't have this on there because one day I was working with people and brushing them because they were recovering from alcohol and drug addiction and different things. I worked as a counselor for many years too. And the thing with them, it didn't have anything on it. I did at first, I put buckskin on it and it kept falling off. It kept falling off. Finally, I went to sleep one night and the creator came to me and he said, Lucinda, he said, don't put anything on this. The eagle is the closest thing to me. You can see an eagle that's a dot in the sky. That's sacred. And so don't put any buckskin on there because the healing comes from the feathers. And so my little great-granddaughter, 3 years old, I feather them all the time. And she had a feather at home that she picked up. Oh, they were down feeding the ducks down Lewiston. She picked up a feather off the ground and she starts feathering her mom. And she says, this is what Granny does. She feathers us. So she had that idea. She do what, you know, grandma did, great grandma did. So, yeah. So I teach them as much as I can about our traditions, our culture, our spirituality. So they will be a warrior in both worlds because they're going to have to go through school like I did. And I got my master's degree in the white world, but I also have a master's degree as being an Indian woman. And I had to go study to learn my dad's side, which was coastal. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say my area comes from Bitterroot to the Salish Sea, because my dad, all the tribes were one over on the coast before. They're all related. My dad could have gone down to Tulalip and enrolled as Tulalip because they're all the tribe. They're all coastal. We have many cousins on the Lummi that build canoes and they build the totems and everything. Those are all people related to us, to my dad. And so, you know, I consider my area to be from the Bitterroots to the Salish Sea. I identify myself. That's how I identify me. And one time I was working as a counselor for a Lazy F Methodist church camp over in Ellensburg. And this one boy that was from Central Washington University came over and worked with me. And he was another counselor at that church camp. And he says, why do we always have to do everything in the native way? Why do we do this? Why do we have to do this? Because I taught him about the moss on the side of the tree it grows. I taught him about the different things you could eat. And he says, why do we have to always do everything native? I said, okay, what's your background? I said, what nationality are you? He says, well, I'm German. I said, okay, you come tomorrow and you do a presentation for these kids as a German. And he came in the morning and he says, go ahead, take over class. And I knew that was going to happen because my teepee was right on the Menashtash Creek. I slept on the rocks. I didn't have a mattress. I had my sleeping bag. I slept on the river rocks.
Wow.
In that teepee all summer long to take care of those kids. And they were inner city kids. And some of them, you know, have... Pardon?
You took care of your back.
But with those kids, you know, a lot of them were inner city kids. And some of them were at Tacoma and different places. And I also taught them the nomenclature of horses to saddle and bridle and do all those things because we'd take them to ride and they'd have to learn everything about the horse. And so I taught that to some of them too. And there were some of those inner city kids that left and they said, can I call you mom? And they were going back to the inner city. I said, sure, you can call me mom if you want to. That's a name. If you want to call me that, that's fine. But some of them just cried and said, can you be my mom?
Well, that says a lot. I mean, not only who their moms might have been, but also the role you played.
But I just had a window just that summer to teach them as much as I could. You know, like I'm, you know, trying to help you learn and understand us a little bit better now. I just had a window of opportunity to do that with those kids.
Yeah.
Yes, I make my grandkids their moccasins. Uh-huh. You know, I make some necklace and regalia for them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do that because, and I made some of their baby boards. I do that because I'm their great grandma. I do bead work. I make dolls. I was in the art show at the Clearwater River Casino. They asked certain people to go present their artwork. Mm-hmm. And I thought we were just supposed to do an art show. Mm-hmm. So I had the table all with my things that I made on that table and decorated. I brought one of my horses, an artist made in 2004 that was from Oklahoma. I can't remember his name. But anyway, I had that horse and I laid my necklaces over that horse. And then I had some dolls and baskets and different things that I made on that table, and thinking it was just to show them. And some people wanted to actually buy some of my things. Yeah, see, I wear a dress that my grandmother wore, and it's over 100 years old. My grandmother died in 1967, and I still wear her shawl dress.
Wow.
And some of the regalia that I have is over 100 years old. And one pair of moccasins that I gave to my granddaughter, they're over 100 years old. They're all fully beaded. But I gave those to her because I got three different pairs and I thought, well, she needs to know these things.
Lucy concludes this interview by discussing her commitment to preserving the land and her culture and her passion for education and the kids.
We have to continue to try and keep trying and keep trying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one day I see myself maybe being in a museum. I see my belongings, my regalia and things possibly being in a museum, because one day there won't be any Nez Perce left. My mother was full-blood Nez Perce, and she's gone. And what about the rest of us? You know, one day we're not going to be here, but we need to teach what we can about nature, spirituality, things that will help the earth and be in one with the earth. I say that the kids also need to be pretty much involved with this because that's where we start. We start with these youth. We teach them about nature and animals. We let them know the humanistic approach to them. So that's why I brought this for the kids, so they can take these home and remember grizzly bear in a good way. We start with them.
Yes.
So that's why I brought this for them. We need to work with them.
Well, thank you so much, Lucy, for taking the time. This has been wonderful. What an education. I'm so honored to be in your country with your fish and your rivers. And may we all protect it together.
Thank you. So thanks for having me.